Everybody needs just the right amount of fuel to get going in the morning. For some, a nice McDonald's egg and cheese bagel is just enough to do it. Others might prefer a McDonald's bacon egg and cheese bagel. Or perhaps a sausage egg and cheese bagel. And there are those where nothing will do but a hearty McDonald's steak egg and cheese bagel. Four different breakfast bagels to get you going. Tomorrow morning, give your engine a head start at participating McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Hi, I'm John Bearer, the host and lead researcher for Stories of Sacrifice, American POW-MIA podcast, and the U.S. POW-MIA Family Locating. A free forensic genealogy public service I provide to support POW-MIA families trying to get their loved one identified and brought home. First, I want to thank you, our listeners, for your interest in the Stories of Sacrifice podcast. Our goal with the podcast is to tell the world about the sacrifice these brave heroes gave for the freedoms we enjoy every day. They gave our country their last full measure. They give us their tomorrow for our freedom today. Second, we would like to raise public awareness that thousands of these heroes from World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and the Cold War have still not yet been found or returned to the United States, with many still buried as unknowns in our own national cemeteries. Their families still waiting for our government to disinter and identify them. So what can you do to support this important mission? First, if you are a relative of a missing in action service member, you can visit the Defense POW-MIA Accounting Agency website for more information about providing a family reference DNA sample. If you want more information, you can also contact me at john@uspowmiafamilylocating.com. Even if you're not related to an MIA, you can contact your members of Congress to request they allocate enough funding to support the POW-MIA mission and to change the DPAA policy to a DNA lead process and create additional public partnerships to disinter and process the remains for those that are buried as unknown. You can also help us in our mission by sharing these podcast stories with your friends, family, and consider sharing them on your own social media. We would also appreciate if you could leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. You can also visit www.storiesofsacrifice.org and leave us a review there. You can visit our affiliate links on our website where we will earn a small commission on your purchases at no extra cost to you. If you feel moved to do so, please visit our donation links on our website to help us continue this important mission. Just sharing these stories helps us greatly, and we cannot thank you enough for listening. Sit back and relax, and we hope you enjoy today's show. Welcome to Stories of Sacrifice, World War II American POW-MIA's podcast. The voice of the missing in action and the voice of those buried as unknowns in our national cemeteries. I'm your host and lead researcher, John Bearer.
Over 75,000 service members are still listed as missing in action from World War II. Of those, over 30,000 are currently listed as active pursuit by the Defense POW-MIA Accounting Agency. Active pursuit meaning they could possibly be identified with the proper family reference sample DNA being on file with the Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. The process of donating DNA reference material is easy, painless, and free of charge. If you are the relative of a missing service member, you can contact the Service Casualty Office of the MIA for information on how to provide a DNA sample. The Service Casualty Office will mail to your home a DNA donor kit that contains a donor consent form, instruction form, 3 cheek swabs, and a shipping envelope. All you have to do is fill out the paperwork, rub the inside of your cheek with the swabs, place the swabs back into the containers, and affix the label. The collected samples are then placed in a pre-addressed and prepaid envelope and then mailed to the Armed Forces DNA Identification Lab at Dover. That's it. It's a completely painless process. To get more information about your missing in action relative, you can visit our website, uspowmiafamilylocating.com, and we can help you to determine if your relative is currently listed on the DPAA active pursuit list and the next steps to help get them identified. Just visit our website or email john@uspowmiafamilylocating.com.
Welcome to today's Story of Sacrifice podcast. We have some very exciting news to share with our listeners, so please stick with us to the very end to find out more. On today's podcast, we are telling you about a little-known cavalry regiment that served in the Philippines, the 26th Cavalry Regiment of the Philippine Scouts. This regiment is better known for its heroic last U.S. cavalry charge on horseback against an opposing enemy force. But little is known about the brave American officers and the Filipino enlisted men of the 26th, who bravely held their positions and sacrificed themselves to keep America and the Philippines free. I'm joined today with Cal Boardman, who is the nephew of First Lieutenant Carol Calhoun, who was an officer with the 26th Cavalry Regiment. Currently, First Lieutenant Calhoun is listed as missing in action. Hi, Cal. Welcome to today's show.
Hello, John. Thank you for inviting me to tell this story. It's been a journey.
Yeah. Well, can you tell us about your Uncle Cal and prior to the war or leading up to the war?
Okay. Well, Carol, that was his given name, but everybody called him Cal, maybe for obvious reasons, but he went by Cal. And so Cal, I'm going to call him Cal Calhoun, at least up until the time he's a first lieutenant, and then he becomes a lieutenant. But Cal Calhoun was born in Idaho, Burley, Idaho, in 1917. And at the time he was born, he had an older brother, Gomez Calhoun, and everybody called him Mez. So Cal and Mez were the two kids at the time. When Cal Calhoun became 2 years old, they had another sibling born, a daughter. And it was about 5 years after that that their father, Joseph Calhoun, died of a ruptured appendicitis. The medicine wasn't quite the same in those days as it is in these days. Mm-hmm. About a year later, their mother remarried. And from that marriage, came another daughter. So there were four siblings, two boys and two girls that lived in Burley. Their grandparents, and this is important, I think, to the story, their grandparents lived in a ranching community on the border of Idaho and Utah, and the community's name was Alamo, Idaho, and being a ranching town, I can't really call it a town. It's essentially got one a little store, and the rest are just ranching homes, even to this day. So most of the members of their family, my family as well on that side, are buried in this little boot hill kind of cemetery up on the side of a hill right above Alamo, Idaho. It's a wonderful, remote, but gorgeous place. Cal graduated from high school, and his brother clearly had graduated 2 years prior. They both had joined the Idaho National Guard. Because of their prior experience in a ranching community, Cal particularly loved horses. He rode them every chance he got. And so when he joined the Idaho National Guard, for him, it was a natural assignment to be part of the cavalry of the Idaho National Guard. And during his training, and he joined when he was 17 years old, so he joined pretty early, but it wasn't too long before he was recognized for his acumen on the back of a horse and his military knowledge. And he was the only one and I can't remember the year, probably when he was 18 or 19, that was chosen to go train the 26th Cavalry, well, not the 26th Cavalry, but to train in Fort Riley, Kansas, with a colonel who will eventually be his commanding officer when he reached the Philippines. But at this point, he was still a member of the National Guard, and yet he was being trained in cavalry tactics at Fort Riley, Kansas. It wasn't too long after the completion of his training that on December 20th, 1938, he resigned from the Idaho National Guard, and on that exact same day, he joined the regular Army of the United States. Now, interestingly, his older brother, who had also been a member of the Idaho National Guard, did exactly the same thing on the same day. They both resigned from the Idaho National Guard. They both joined the regular Army. Cal, in his case, went to the cavalry. Mez, in his case, went to the infantry, and they began their training. That was 1938. Cal was sent to Fort Bliss to continue training in cavalry tactics. And then ultimately, a few years later, after training literally around the country, he ended up stationed in California, got on the ship in February of 1941, the USS Grant, that sailed from San Francisco to Manila, at which point he became a member of the 26th Cavalry Philippine Scouts. At that time, his older brother, who incidentally was my father, was assigned to help put together the 70th Division of Infantry. And it was being formed in Oregon, and their nickname were the Trailblazers. And he was captain at the time that he met my mother at one of his stations in Texas. They met, fell in love. A year later, I was born. They wanted to name me after my Uncle Cal, but they didn't want to call me Carol, so they thought, well, let's call him Calvin, which they did officially. So my name is officially Calvin, but I like Cal, just like my uncle did. And at that time, shortly thereafter, the division was ready. It was ready to go. It was sent to Marseille, France, in October of 1944. They were sent directly to the front up by Strasbourg and the Alsace region of northeast France at that same time, and that was right after the Battle of the Bulge, or right at the end of it. Hitler sent his crack troops from Norway down into this same region in what he called Operation Nordwind. And that's where the 70th Division, this green division that had not faced any action, got Hitler's best. And it was a brutal fight, but the Americans pushed forward. They took territory right overlooking Germany in the Spitzerland Heights in the Alsace region. My dad was killed at the front leading his first battalion. And he is buried in the Epinal American Military Cemetery in France. Now, I tell you that because my journey with respect to my uncle began during a trip about 6 years ago when my wife and I and another couple friends, good friends of ours, retraced my father's footsteps in terms of his battle experience. We went to the cemetery in Epinal. And as the superintendent was taking us around the grounds, he particularly pointed to graves that represented two brothers. And there were, I can't remember, between 5 and 10 sets of brothers that were buried side by side in the Epinal Cemetery. I mentioned to him that my father, who was buried there as a major, had a brother who was killed in the Philippines, but he's missing in action. And the family knows very little about him. The superintendent said, if you ever find him, if he's recovered and identified, I'm sure the Army would be proud to bury him next to his brother, your father, in the cemetery in France.
Oh, that'd be cool.
That started my journey. To be honest, I knew very little about Calhoun. I knew a good bit more about my father, but even that, when I was 6 years old, I was 1 year old when my father was killed. 5 years later, my mother remarried. 2 years after that, my new father, my adopted father, adopted me, and that's when I carry now the name Boardman, proudly carry the name. But I also proudly still have the name Calhoun as a part of my namesake. So I thought, I know a fair amount about my father because of the trip that we took over there, but I know very little about Calhoun. The first thing I did, and this was starting 4 or 5 years ago, and one of my recommendations for anybody who is either beginning this journey themselves or that they've been on their journey for some time, to go back and read as much of the history as you can. It, for one thing, it makes your journey relative to your family member, for me anyway, more real, to put him in context of the history of the time. But secondly, it's just amazing what information is out there. I started reading the history of the Spanish-American War. That was the initial spot where the United States ended up having the Philippines as one of their territories. They were not a territorial country prior to 1898, but after that, they now had expanded their territories to a large degree because of the spoils of war that they got at the end of the Spanish-American War. So that whole history of American involvement in the Philippines, I think, is important to understand the connection between the Philippine people and the American people, and why the 26th Cavalry, not to mention all the other units that we have read about, and many of them that you have on your podcast, John, to understand why they were there in the first place. Uh-huh. So that leads me up to the time they were in the 26th Cavalry. Fortunately, among the things that I read were a number of letters that he had sent, not only to my father and to his sister, but also to his mother. I am so grateful to not only my father, but their mother, who saved these letters, but also the sisters of both boys who were ultimately clearly killed in World War II, who saved them all these years. And I feel so honored to be able to read them, because it's really through those letters that I've gotten to know Calhoun on a more personal basis. I know his record. I've fortunately been able to get his individual disease personnel file from the Army a few years ago, actually. So I knew that, but I didn't know him personally. And he was a character. He described his journeys across on the U.S. Grant. He described his impressions of the Philippines, and particularly his impressions of the land and of the Philippine scouts. There are a number of quotes that, if we have time, I'd like to read to you some, because they just, I think, exemplify the incredible training and culture of the Philippine Scouts.
Oh yeah, we've got time if you want to read some of them, definitely.
Well, all right, while I'm telling you this, let me see if I can kind of find a little bit of them. All right, here we go. What she did, their mother, is save these letters, and so most of them are addressed, "Dear Mom." Here is one that he wrote to his mom. I'm just going to quote a few of them, and just because I think they're beautifully descriptive of the Philippines in early 1941. "Dear Mom, here are a few snapshots that might interest you. This place is almost like a summer resort. It's everything I imagined, including hot. Traffic drives on the left side here, which is rather confusing. Cars also have a steering wheel on the right side. Orchids grow wild here. Beautiful flowers of all descriptions grow here the year round, and the singing birds never go south. Native Filipinos wear as little as possible. Shoes are considered a nuisance. Older children are required by law to be at least half covered. They are, the top half. Young ones go naked. Everyone sleeps an hour or two after lunch, siesta time, and no one ever hurries. Time is of no importance. Something that strikes me as novel is the length of time Filipinos have to work at anything before he is considered worthwhile. One of the officers was helping me select a cook yesterday. He asked his own houseboy if the prospective cook was any good. His houseboy shrugged his shoulder and replied, "Me."
Looking for a way to make quick cash? Making cash with DoorDash is super easy, guys. I love driving around my town, and now I can do that and get paid. Not to mention the sign-up process was so easy. Download the DoorDash Driver app today to get started.
How many steps do you take before you have foot pain? Hi, it's Jonathan Cotton with the Good Feet Store, and the truth is, the battle between our feet and the concrete or asphalt usually winds up with our feet losing. Studies show that about 75% of people will experience some kind of foot pain by middle age. I found that out a number of years ago with plantar fasciitis, and I tried to remedy it with shoes and drugstore cushions that didn't work. Finally, I went to the Good Feet Store, was personally fitted for arch supports, and I loved them so much, I bought the store. Without a plan to protect and support your feet, it is likely you could one day be one of the millions living with chronic foot pain. Don't wait until pain demands that you visit us. Stop by the Good Feet Store today and let one of our trained arch support specialists fit you with your personal system of arch supports.
The Good Feet Store is located in Fairfax, Leesburg, Rockville, Baltimore, and Hunt Valley, and in Annapolis in the Annapolis Harbor Center. For more information, go to goodfeet.com.
Maybe so. I don't think so. He only cooked 15 years. The Filipino usually serves 21 years in the Philippine Scouts before he is made sergeant. About a week ago, a buck private with 8 years service was promoted to first class private. His friends think he's either a genius or the American officers are getting very lax. Write me everything you can think of. Love, Cal. Here's another one. This is a shorter segment. We have an excellent regimental CO. The morale of both officers and men is very high. Philippine Scout soldiers is a saluting demon. They are very loyal and would do almost anything for their officers. They are very serious in their work. You cannot joke with them like you can with an American soldier. There's what he talks about the headhunters, but he's also mentioning that he's learning to speak the language Tagalog, and he put some Tagalog phrases in his letter that he sent back. And this is from the last letter that he wrote. The temperature got down to 90 degrees here last night and caused quite a sensation. Some people actually threatened to wear pajamas to bed.
Oh, man.
People in the United States are probably all worried about the Japs taking the Philippines. We inhabitants of this forsaken tropical paradise don't even give it a second thought. Palam Napogagayan, and I'm sure I didn't pronounce that right. Goodbye now, write soon, yours, Cal. That was his last letter. And it was written November 23rd, 1941. Japanese invaded 1 week later.
Yeah.
Or 2 weeks later, I guess it would be, right?
Yep.
2 weeks later, they invaded. And nothing else was heard. And in fact, I've not been able to find any letters from at least those around that I've been looking at that were written. That those men were pretty busy starting on December the 8th. they had their hands full.
Yeah, they did.
And so they just, at least in Cal's case, that was his last letter.
Wow.
But it just gives you a sense of his respect for the Philippine people. And in other letters, he talks about how gorgeous the landscape was.
Yeah,
and so in those snapshots that I referred to, I'm figuring out a way to show those at some future point.
Yeah, they used to call Manila or the Philippines the Pearl of the Orient. So that definitely explains it.
Yeah, it was mighty beautiful at that time. Now, what he didn't realize as to what he was getting into, of course, I don't think anybody, at least at that level, really understood. But the powers that be knew that Japan was making signals, moves. Certainly, there was enough a belief by the top brass in the U.S. military that the Japanese were likely to launch something somewhere. They're not sure exactly when, but they were pretty convinced it was going to happen. So much so that during 1941, when he was there, they spent time not only trying to train the Philippine soldier, but also to prepare plans, at least the officers did, for the eventuality of the Japanese invasion. And as you mentioned in others of your podcasts, John, that there are these fallback positions that had been all planned out.
Yeah, that was part of War Plan Orange.
Yes. The only part that really wasn't planned out was the fact that it came as quickly as it did. They were thinking it would happen in April or May of 1942. Honestly, it would have been a stretch had they been ready even in April or May of 1942, because the equipment they had was woefully inadequate in most cases. And I'm sure you and your listeners know this, but in most cases they still had World War I equipment. And where they did have some World War II equipment, they oftentimes didn't have enough ammunition to even have a practice shot on the range. Or if they did, it was one or two shots. It was just enough to know how the gun works, but not enough to get very proficient at it. In terms of the mechanized backup, and I'm only talking about the 26th Cavalry here. I can't speak any more about the 31st Infantry that I know your relative was a part of, John.
Yep.
But in terms of the 26th Cavalry, their mechanized support was fairly thin. Of course, they were cavalry, and in those days, they expected to use the horse militarily, which they did. In fact, the 26th Cavalry became known as the horse soldiers of the Philippines. And in probably in other podcasts or in other areas, you know that the last horseback charge in U.S. Army cavalry history occurred by a unit of the 26th Cavalry in March of 1942 in the Philippines. But ironically, at the time, shortly thereafter, when the Japanese were successfully pushing across the Philippines, a lot more slowly than they had planned, by the way, and we can talk about that later. About the time that the cavalry saw the handwriting on the wall, General Wainwright made the decision to essentially disband the cavalry at that point. We're talking about March, latter part of March. And the horses were eventually killed for food for the rest of the soldiers. And of course, everybody was really hungry starving at that point. But the cavalry refused to partake in any of the horse meat at that time.
Yep.
But ironically, back in Washington, in that almost identically the same time, the United States Army was signing the documents to remove from office essentially the last commandant of the United States Army Cavalry. So it officially was ending about the same time that it was ending in the Philippines. From then on, it had begun during World War II as a mixed armor, mechanized as well as horseback. But by the end of March and the first part of April of 1942, the cavalry now became mechanized. So it was actually a very important part of U.S. military history that was occurring in the Philippines in that particular point in time. But let's back up a little bit to the invasion. As I mentioned, the soldiers that were being trained by the Americans were Filipinos. The enlisted men were all Filipinos. Of the 26th Cavalry, there were 765, I believe, enlisted men in the 26th Cavalry. There were 55 American officers in the 26th Cavalry. And the job of the officers was to get that regiment in tip-top fighting shape. As I mentioned, they didn't have a lot of equipment, but their commander, Colonel Pierce, the same guy that my uncle trained with when he was in the Idaho National Guard, drilled them. And their morale, their ability to use a horse in a military setting strategically was top-notch. The 26th Cavalry ended up with, and I can't remember exactly, but I think it was 3 United States Presidential Unit Awards and 2 or 3 Philippine Presidential Unit Citations. And as many or maybe more than any other one unit in the war. And they accomplished this in 4 months worth of active battle. It was an amazing unit that Wainwright signed to help slow down the Japanese, as he'd also assigned the 31st Infantry and a number of others to try to slow down this juggernaut of the Japanese that had landed on the northeast and northwest shores of Luzon.
Yep.
Let's move ahead a little bit. About a week after the invasion, it was clear where the Japanese were landing. And there, at that time, there were 6 scout cars. They had some other mechanized trucks and other vehicles, but the scout car was this hybrid vehicle that was lightly armored. It was armored, but it was not an attack vehicle. It was more of a strategic surveillance, quick attack, sort of like a horse. I mean, it was designed to be able to move quickly, go over tough terrain, get in there and get out, could carry up to 7 men. It looked like a cross between a Jeep and a Land Rover. It could be mounted with up to 3 machine guns on this vehicle. They had 6 of these cars at the start of the war. Cars is kind of a misnomer.
It is.
I don't quite know what to call it, but it was this amazing vehicle. What the officers did is that they split it in half. 3 of the cars were sent up to the northeast part of the Philippines for surveillance and to gather information, send it back to headquarters. The other 3 were sent up the northwest quadrant to do the same thing. The 3 going up to the northeast part of the island was where my uncle was assigned. He was sent with those 3 scout cars. They eventually came back the beginning of the 4th week in December. So 2 weeks later, they came back. The 3 that went to the northwest, where most of the landing force actually occurred, one of those cars got a direct artillery hit and killed Lieutenant George and all the men, the enlisted men who were in that scout car. Another one got hit and damaged, but no one was killed in that one. But the scout car itself was put out of commission. One scout car made it back. So out of the six, there were four left around December 28th or 29th when they all rejoined the 26th Cavalry Regiment. And this was north of the Layak Junction. So one of those defensive lines, one of those Agent Orange.
Right.
the orange plan, the plan to move them back in stages. And generally, the 26th Cavalry, when they decided to move back from one stage to the next defensive stage, 26th Cavalry was often the last unit to leave because, for the most part, they were very mobile with their scout cars and their horses. That gets us through some pretty fierce fighting. I must say, while it's on my mind, in a four-month period of time of the fierce fighting that I just mentioned, of those 55 officers, two-thirds were killed. Of the 765 enlisted men, just under two-thirds were killed.
Wow.
Now, I'm not talking about being wounded. There were, I'm sure, many more that were wounded. I'm talking about the killed in action casualties. A two-thirds casualty rate. That was pretty tough.
Yeah, that's actually a very high casualty rate.
Yeah, and I think it just reflected the fact that they were there pretty much to the end. And so anyway, they were pulling back to the Layak Junction. Layak Junction was the site of the first Philippine scout who was eventually recognized with the Congressional Medal of Honor. And the American officer, Neninger, Lieutenant Neninger, was also recognized. And he fought just right south of there, as I remember.
That's correct. Yep.
It was fierce fighting. And there was some honorable actions that occurred out of this unit particularly. So it was time after they blew the bridge at Layak Junction, which was right at the top of the Bataan Peninsula, which was the plan for Plan Orange, is to get all the men and as much equipment and supplies as they could onto this peninsula for eventual rescue. And of course, we know that didn't happen. To a large degree, I think, particularly after Pearl Harbor, the officers knew that it wasn't going to happen. They still fought valiantly as they retreated across Luzon and then eventually onto the Bataan Peninsula. That gets us then to the everybody except the 31st Infantry and the 26th Cavalry had moved south to the next line, which was about 5 miles to the south. I mean, you know, for me, I read about all this action, and it feels like it's a huge distance between actions, but really, 5 miles is not very far.
No,
and that's particularly why artillery was so effective, Japanese artillery, as well as ours.
Exactly.
But to slow them down, but it was an effective tactic. So anyway, now we are up to January the 7th. And on the early morning of January 7th, about 2:30 in the morning, it was about a fourth of a moon. I don't know if it was raining, but I know it was reasonably dark. At about 2:30 in the morning, the general who commanded the 31st Infantry got the permission or order, I'm not sure which, to withdraw to that next defensive line. And so they pulled out at about 2:30. On their left flank was the 26th Cavalry. They sent a message, somebody sent a message to the 26th Cavalry, but the passwords had been changed and the cavalry had not been given the new information. In any event, the communication between the 31st and the 22nd had been garbled.
Oh.
The 26th Cavalry did not know that the 31st Infantry had left. So to the right of the 26th Cavalry was nothing, because the 31st Infantry had gone. Cavalry knew that they were about to be attacked. Now, this is in the middle of the night, dark. So what he said, well, let's send the scout cars. Remember, there are four of them. Let's send the scout cars with all the regimental records, all of the colors, the banners, all of the official documents of the cavalry. Let's put them on these four scout cars. Let's also put the one civilian who was traveling. As it turns out, there was a United Press International reporter by the name of Franz Weisberg, who was, we might call it today, embedded with the 26th Cavalry.
Uh-huh.
And he was not sure that he could, well, he wasn't a good rider in terms of riding horses. And he must not have been in the greatest of shape. I don't know. In any event, he and the colonel decides that he should escape with the scout cars. He gets on the scout cars. My uncle was still a lieutenant by this time, first lieutenant. And he had command of one of the cars with the enlisted man. And there were two other lieutenants with him, actually three. One was Lieutenant Cahoon, my uncle, another Lieutenant Graves, who I will talk about a little bit more in a minute. And the other, a Cunningham, there were three, I'm sorry. And so they set out. By now, it's about 4:30 in the morning. This is 2 hours after the 31st had pulled out. 2 hours with nobody in front of them. The Japanese thought, well, here we go. Let's move ahead. So the Japanese had moved into this place vacated by the 31st Infantry. And unbeknownst to this platoon, they drove right into the middle of them in the middle of the night.
Oh, man.
And they didn't know what hit. It just, these are all pieced together from, story I'm telling you, is pieced together from a wide variety of sources of journals, journal articles, books, diaries, all kinds of stuff. Nobody's ever written anything specifically about what happened to this platoon of six scout cars. Most everybody has talked about them in some way or another. So I've just pieced together this story to create this narrative that I'm sharing with you.
Yep.
Then, so when they ran headlong in, one scout car, presumably the one in the back, was able to turn around with one American officer.
Welcome to Parent Teacher Night. Oh, yes, Miss Garner.
If you have one of those airline credit cards, you're probably not earning double miles on every purchase.
You're right. My card only gets extra miles on some types of purchases.
With the Capital One Venture card, you earn unlimited double miles everywhere.
Wait, but where can we use them?
You can use Capital One Venture miles on any travel purchase.
Venture gets an A+.
Capital One, what's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Everybody needs just the right amount of fuel to get going in the morning. For some, a nice McDonald's egg and cheese bagel is just enough to do it. Others might prefer a McDonald's bacon egg and cheese bagel. Or perhaps a sausage egg and cheese bagel. And there are those where nothing will do but a hearty McDonald's steak egg and cheese bagel. Four different breakfast bagels to get you going. Tomorrow morning, give your engine a head start at participating McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
And two enlisted men, and they made their way back to the regiment. Again, it's in the middle of the night. There's the eyewitness accounts of those who returned to the regiment. Out of the other cars that were under attack, there are three of them. There were three other Philippine scout enlisted men who were able to escape unharmed through the brush in the middle of the night and make their way back to the regiment. So out of the about 22 men, six made it back to the regiment. Franz Weisberg, the civilian reporter, was wounded for which he ultimately got a Purple Heart, by the way, when the war was over.
See, that's amazing.
Yes, and there were a few. Ernie Pyle was another. There were a few journalists who were awarded the Purple Heart, and Wiseman was one of them. He was wounded and captured. And a quick sidebar on him is that when he was captured, he was eventually taken to, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, John, Billabod Prison,
yeah.
Prison. And that's where he stayed for 3 years. I think it was about 3 years until he was repatriated, I guess. And during that three times, he kept records. And in his other assignments before the Philippines, he had opportunities, I'm sure, to learn the language, the Japanese language. So he probably was a pretty valuable guy for the Japanese. And they had him doing scribe kind of work. But on the side, he would keep records of who in that prison were captured or killed. And then he would hide them, of course, because if Japanese found that, they would have executed him, civilian or no. When the war was over, he wrote various articles that were published. And in one of them that I had a chance to find, he mentioned that at the end of the war, he gave that list of names to the army. At that point, it disappeared.
Oh.
Now, I would think to the work that you do and others also do, that list, those records that he kept would be a valuable source of information. And I cannot tell you what happened to them. I have asked everyone I could think of, did they know who he was? You can find out a lot about him, but about the records that were turned over to the U.S. Army, nothing. Including, and I've asked my case manager if they ever knew anything, and I mentioned it to my DPAA family update last April. They didn't know anything. I cannot believe they just flat were thrown away.
Yeah, they're probably lost in the archives there somewhere.
But somewhere out there, maybe, this very valuable list of soldiers who were captured, imprisoned, and potentially eventually died. But anyway, that's a little sidebar. So what happens is Calhoun is killed. The regiment, after they find out there has been an ambush, they go cross country. The cars are the last car is abandoned. Then they go on horseback and on foot. And it takes them 2 days to rejoin the 31st Infantry and everybody else at this next defensive line. But they made it back. The remaining 15 soldiers, two American officers and 13 enlisted men, are missing in action. Now, I can tell you the names of the two American officers, and I can tell you the names of three of the 13 Philippine Scout enlisted men. But the remaining 10 Philippine Scout enlisted men, I can't even tell you their names, much less what their service numbers might be, or if anybody's looking for them, or anything. It's a shame that in some sense they're not even identified. So that's a whole nother story. Part of my effort is to try to narrow the possibilities of those 765 enlisted men names down to a set that might contain those 10 names. Mm-hmm. And while I'm there, I've narrowed down the 765 down to 30.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good.
And I posted the names of those 30, actually 36, and then posted them on two Philippine World War II related websites. Six were, I guess identified is the right word, as either surviving the war or being killed in the war. And that left 30. So I have 30 names from whom I think those 10 unknowns should come. I've tried to track down as much as I could the family members of the three enlisted men whose names I do know, and I've had absolutely zero luck doing that. In terms of the two American officers, Lieutenant Carol Cahoon, his family, mine, has now provided the DNA reference samples. And the family of the other American officer, Lieutenant Stevens Graves, has also provided sufficient DNA reference samples. So for the American officers, we're at 100% of the two anyway that went missing that night.
Yeah.
That's the story, and it took me, I apologize, longer than I had thought it would to tell it to you, but that's kind of where we are now. Last April, as I mentioned, I met in the DPAA family update. I gave them a copy of a little paper I had written, sharing what information I had at that time, that I said that there were 15 names, 15 missing in action. I didn't have any names to go with them at that point, and I had pretty much figured out what had happened in the ambush, but I gave all that to them last April. They gave to me in return their report on First Lieutenant Carol I. Cahoon, and at the end of that report, they said that they had identified, that's not the right word, narrowed down the possibilities of remains, unknown remains, down to, ironically, 15 from the Layak Junction Coolis area where the ambush occurred. So our two numbers linked up.
Well, that's pretty good.
It was after that that I didn't really hear anything further until December, just 2 months ago. And I'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
In the meantime, what I was doing, though, is thanks to individuals like yourself and John Eakin and Chad Hill and J.P. Speeder and so many others, by the time mid-December rolled around, I had been able to be the recipient of 15 X-Files that I was hoping would pretty much cover the possibilities of the 15 unknowns in that area. And so I set out to learn more about those 15 X-Files. And I can talk more about that if you want or not, but I set out.
Please do.
Each X-File, not each one, many of the X-Files, most of them, in fact, had map coordinates associated with where the remains were located when the war was over, and Sergeant Abby Abraham was tasked to go look for them. There were these X-Files, and the coordinates were not longitude-latitude coordinates, as it turns out. They were coordinates of a 1944 U.S. Army map that Abraham had, and Chad Hill, fortunately, knew how to find that map. He sent them to me, and with his help, we were able to plot the location of each of those X-File recoveries on this map. And that helped us determine the actual route that the 26th Cavalry Scout Car Platoon probably took in the middle of the night on January 7th, 1942. Because those grave sites would have been, in some sense, the fingerprints of where they were.
Yep.
When they were killed. I asked the DPAA if they would share with me the 15 X-Files that they had indicated were present. They never did that. Even to today, they have not.
Yeah.
So what I did, and their reasons I sort of understand, but what I asked instead was if they could provide me with the 15 X-File numbers. Then I could cross-reference their 15 X-Files to the 15 X-Files that John Eakin particularly helped me get. Mm-hmm. And DPAA, to their credit, they did that. I got all 15 X-File numbers, and that occurred mid-December, just a few months ago. Since then, I have spent time looking at each of the X-Files because I was able to get the ones that I was not given before, and I was also able to tell DPAA that they missed a few because I had some that they did not have.
That's pretty good.
And I haven't heard back. But anyway, now they have more information. I continued and have finished investigating each one of the X-Files to try to decide which ones are likely to be my uncle and Lieutenant Graves. And I think I know which X-Files they are. And if in fact that's right, then we know which graves in the Manila American Cemetery contain the remains of the two of them. In that email that they sent me, giving me the X-File numbers in mid-December, there was this one sentence at the end. They said that the DPAA historians have now agreed to disinter 3 of the now 23 X-Files out of that particular battle area.
Oh, that's amazing.
They've decided to disinter 3. 2 of those 3 are the 2 that I think have a high probability of being Lieutenant Graves and Cahoon.
And how did you come up with that probability of being your uncle and Lieutenant Graves?
A couple of things. So most importantly was the interrogation report that Abby Abraham filled out when he recovered when they were initially buried by the Filipino or whoever buried them way back when. And Sergeant Abraham was directed to these various sites. And as you know, he did thousands of these that are documented in essentially his journal, a book by Oh God, Where Are You? And anybody who's doing this sort of work has to be must reading for any family. It's just it blew me away. And thanks to John Eakin for sending it to me. It's just incredible. Anyway, in that interrogation report, you get a whole lot of stuff. Of course, you get a skeletal chart with what bones were recovered. And not surprisingly, none of the X-Files, I only looked at 23, none of them have a complete skeleton. In fact, the skeletal parts are, I can't add a percent, but it's really not a huge amount of skeletal remains. If you look at the complete skeleton, for a lot of reasons that we could talk about, there are a lot of reasons why they're only partial skeletons. In any event, on the interrogation report, you get the coordinates. That puts the burial in the likely path of this ambush, which I may add was only maybe a half a mile at the most, from the Bataan Death March route. As we know, there were many casualties along that route and many rudimentary burials along that route. So the closer these X-Files were to that Death March route, the less likely they'd be a part of the ambush.
Yeah.
Who knows, but less likely. So one is the proximity of where the remains were recovered. And the second would be not the skeletal remains, that didn't help a lot, but at least not yet. Future DNA, of course, it's critical, but at this point. But then you you listen to the description of where the remains were found, and importantly, Abraham recorded the observations of the man, and generally it was a man, who took Abraham to the burial site. And Abraham would interview this man. Tell us what you found when you buried the remains. And by the way, for these X-Files, clearly these remains, there were no identifying features like dog tags or like a bracelet or any of the paper-oriented kinds of documents like pay stubs or orders or any of that. So they've long gone in this environment.
Yeah, or they could have been stripped off of them by the Japanese as the Japanese came through.
Yeah, or if the Philippines had taken the dog tags, they didn't want to be caught with them, so they would destroy them or throw them away or something. So it's not surprising in many ways that these skeletal remains really had no identifiable physical features other than the bones themselves. And so Abraham interviewed these men who had buried the bodies in the first place as to what they remembered from often 3 years prior. Well, I mean, he was doing this in 1945, 6, and partly in 47. And the ambush occurred, as I said, in January of 42. So that's, you know, that's a stretch. Although if I were to have been put in that horrible place of burying a body from war, I think I'd remember. So yeah. Even though it's a long time, it's one of those events in one's life. I don't think you, at least I, wouldn't forget very much. And so it's reading these interrogation reports that gives you descriptions. So often they were still in their American uniforms, and their uniforms over those years just deteriorated in the humidity and the heat and the bugs and the animals and whatever else. So they were clearly American. Often there was a description of skin color, or you had estimates of height, either from the skeletal structure remains or from the person who was interviewed would say, well, that person was around 6 feet tall or whatever the case may be.
Yep.
And the Filipinos, for the most part, were shorter than those two American officers, for sure. And so you look at the X-Files that were in that area, likely area of the ambush, there were three that were clearly, at least by the interrogation report, they were clearly American. And those are the three that DPAA has already made the order to disinter.
Oh, that's good.
So that's how it happens. I've got to thank DPA for making that decision, those historians whose names I have no clue about. Whether they ever saw my report from April, I have no clue about that either. But I thank them for their diligence to make the decision to research the ambush and to look at their set of X-Files and to make a decision to disinter. That's pretty epic in my mind and in the minds of all the family members of these two American officers. We're very grateful for that. Time will tell, of course. The odds are always against you, perhaps. There's so many things that can still go wrong. There could not be a DNA match. There could not be a dental match. There could not. I mean, the circumstantial evidence is strong, but the direct evidence may prove that it's not him. I've had to come to a place in my life, and to a large degree, as a result of Abby Abraham's book, Oh God, Where Are You? And my reading of Cal Calhoun's letters and his esteem for the Philippines.
Each of us has a purpose. We are destined to do something meaningful, not only to support our loved ones, but to positively impact our communities throughout the country. What do you think a private Christian education looks like? Grand Canyon University graduates 25,000 students yearly and offers more than 225 high-quality programs across 9 colleges. Find your purpose at GCU. Visit gcu.edu.
The men and women who he got to know, that I know if they do say that this is Lieutenant Carol Calhoun, DNA is a match, it will only be a partial skeleton. I know the rest of that skeleton has now become a part of Philippine soil. And after reading Abraham's book and the intense loyalty and appreciation he had for the Filipinos, if that's the way that my story, my uncle's story, Lieutenant Graves' story ends up, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
And I did not think I would ever be at that place, but I am. And I'm just so grateful, actually, that the stars lined up that gave me the opportunity to get to know my uncle. I never did. Nobody in my family really did. So at the very least, we come out of this with a document that we'll hand down to our families generations to come. So at the very least, I'm grateful.
Yeah. And you're putting all this into a book, isn't that correct?
Yes. And I've entitled it Ang Aganap. That's the Tagalog Philippine, the official language of the Philippines, Tagalog. And because Cal Calhoun was learning that language, I thought I should honor the Filipinos and honor him and name this written effort of mine Ang Paganap, which means the quest, because that's what this has been. It's been a quest.
Yeah.
Regardless of how it turns out, it's been a quest. My life has been touched because of it, and I'm so grateful to you and to John Aiken and Chad Hill and J.P. Speeder and others that I acknowledge in my book, but that have unselfishly given of their time and effort to help people like me and like those others on your podcasts whose families are benefiting from all of the incredible work that you're doing, and I could not be more grateful.
Well, there's a reason why we do it, is because we're grateful for what those men did for us and the freedoms that we enjoy today, and that's the main reason why we do what we do. You know, of course,
yes.
You know, a lot of us had family members over there too.
Yes. Yep. So that's my journey, John, and I hope it wasn't too much of a ramble. It's an interesting piece of history.
It is, and you don't hear too much about the 26th Cavalry either, in their endeavors and what they did for, during the defense of Bataan
and
you know, you hear about the last cavalry charge is the main thing you ever hear about, but
right,
you know, they took the brunt of the fighting. You know that.
They did
in most cases. You know, they were their protection force for all the units,
right,
that were retreating to the different defensive positions, and
right,
you know, they were amazing group of guys.
In fact, if anybody, you or anybody else is listening, I've read a ton of books on the Philippine part of World War II. The best one that is readable, it's current. It was published in 2016. And I've got little marker tabs all through this book. It was a major source of information for me. And let me just mention the book. And if anybody wants to know more about the 26th Cavalry's role in World War II, this book is amazing. the title of it is The Doomed Horse Soldiers of Bataan. Yeah. And the subtitle is The Incredible Stand of the 26th Cavalry. And it's written by Raymond G. Wolfe, Jr. And the guy he got to write his introduction was Colonel Edwin Ramsey, who was the guy who led that last horse charge in U.S. Army history, wrote the introduction to Raymond Wolfe's book. I highly recommend this book. It's a good read. It's informative. And who knows, if any of you have a family member that was associated with 26th Cavalry, there's a good chance he'll be mentioned in this book.
Yeah. So on your book, when you get it finished, if somebody wants to receive a copy of it or get a copy of it, how can they go about it?
It will be available on all the major outlets, at least outlets like Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Any bookstore will be able to order it for you if they don't have it in stock directly from the publisher. It's not likely that any bookstore will stock it. I just can't imagine that very many, I can't imagine there's a big market for this thing, because it goes all the way from talking about Spanish-American War all the way to telling you about the life of my uncle. And so I don't know how many people want to know about that, but the lion's share of the book is about what happened, and it's my attempt to figure out what happened to that mechanized portion of the 26th Cavalry. And by the way, MacArthur is the one who pretty much proved in September of 41 that mechanized and horses could work best if they worked together. But in the end, the mechanized is the future of cavalry, and that happened in these the biggest gathering of military forces in our history pre World War II on our soil. It was huge military exercises, but that was where they showed that the future of the cavalry was mechanization.
Yeah, well, and the other thing too there on during the fighting of the Bataan. They did use the 194th Tank and 192nd Tank Battalions on the flanks of the 26th Cavalry.
Improved the incredibly work. Valuable. They I can tell you that what I've read, that folks at 26th Cavalry are wanting more of those. that was a powerful force. We just weren't well equipped. I mean, we just didn't have enough of them.
Yep, exactly. Well, is there anything that we might have forgot to talk about, Cal, or anything else
No.
you want to bring up?
No, and I'd be honored if anybody did end up reading that book and wanted to send me any comments about it. But particularly what I will do in that book, as I have on those two websites, the two Facebook sites are the Philippine Scouts Heritage Society's Facebook page, and the other Facebook page is the Philippine MIA. You're gonna have to help me on this. Oh. Research group.
Yeah. Yep.
The defense. No. Let me find.
Yeah,
it.
The Filipino Filipino American.
American World War II POW MIA Research Group Facebook site. That's a mouthful.
Yep.
But on both of those, I posted the names of those 30 Philippine Scout enlisted men. And by the way, the U.S. Army has made the decision, of course, that all American soldiers are targeted for disinterment and identification. But they also made the decisions that all Philippine Scouts and the families of the Philippine Scouts are eligible for the same service. If it's the Philippine part of the regular Philippine Army, they're not. unfortunately. But if and each one of these 30 names are, well, each one was a Philippine scout. So they are eligible for all of the DPAA services that we've been talking about. And that's really important. And I hope that someday we can determine at least who those other 10 were.
Yeah, the nice thing about that, yeah, the Philippine Scouts were actually an American, assigned as American units, and so the United States is responsible for identifying, like you were saying, identifying and disinterring those remains,
yeah,
and returning them to the family. The other good thing about this whole situation with your case is those other 13 men, the enlisted Philippine Scouts, they do have genealogists there in the Philippines that I'm sure that the Army will task with trying to identify the descendants of those men.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. Because I've tried, at least with respect to the three Philippine names that I know, I've tried to contact their family members or even find out who they are. I've not had any luck. But anyway, there's a lot of work out there to be done. And another thing about this thing is that I hope, and the people that I've heard on your podcasts, and I honor each one of them for all of the incredible work that they've been doing. I know one has created a websites and a sharing of Google Drives, which is incredible. But I hope that each one of us who are going down this journey put something in print and it puts it out there to share with others, because I don't know if my journey will be of any help, but I've met a lot of amazing people. I've examined, I didn't even talk about all the databases that I've had to look at to work through this mystery. All of that, all of those sites, all those links, all of those descriptions, why I used it, why I didn't use it, all of those will be in the book.
Oh, that's going to be a heck of a resource then.
Well, I hope so. And my plan is that it'll be in print maybe sometime in the summer.
Okay. Well, can people contact you directly by email or something?
They may, and my email is easy. It is just my name, actually. It is Cal, C-A-L, dot. B-O-A-R-D-M-A-N. So my name, Cal.Boardman. Well, dot's not my middle name, but
right.
At gmail.com.
All righty. So Cal.Boardman at gmail.com.
That's it. So they're welcome. I would love to hear from them and to share what information I have. And after all, if I can pass on a little of the help that I've received, it'd be well worth it.
Yeah, that's an amazing journey that you went through.
So good work to you, John. I think these podcasts are wonderful.
Yeah.
And I guess I should add, for those of you who don't know Abby Abraham, as I recommended, Oh God, Where Are You? Also, I'd recommend listening to that one podcast, maybe all of them, but particularly that one podcast on John's site, where Abraham is actually interviewed. He's not identified, but it'll be unmistakable. You'll hear this rough, tough voice that just exudes respect. It exudes tenderness. And I wish I would have had the opportunity to shake that guy's hand. But
me too.
It's on John's podcast, so I hope if you haven't heard that, listen to that guy. He's my hero.
Yeah, he did amazing work, and he was the one responsible for disinterring thousands and thousands of American and Filipino scouts, and the work he did. I don't know how he managed to do what he did, and keep the records that he did. And then all at the same time, he was actually told he had to go to the trial of General Homa, the Japanese that was tried and executed for the war crimes.
And he talks about that in your interview.
Yeah, he does.
And surprisingly, he talks about it as a kangaroo court. I thought, here this guy is, he's still being irreverent. I love it.
Exactly. Yeah, that was episode 7 on my podcast where I compiled the interviews of a lot of the POWs who survived.
Yes. And of course, I think he probably said that tongue in cheek. But there was a, you know, Homo was a, he wasn't, well, I won't editorialize. You listen to it for yourself.
Exactly. Well, the interesting thing, you know, that AB brought up in that interview was he didn't want to see General Homa tried for the Bataan Death March and the atrocities that happened on the march. He was more angry about the stuff that happened in the camps.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's a great story, and my respect and honor to all the men who lost their lives, and of course I hope someday one of those X-Files that the DPA has said they're going to disinter will be matched up to the DNA's samples in my family, and then someday I'll be able to the company Lieutenant Carol Cahoon's remains to Epinal, France, to bury them forever next to my father. The military cemeteries do such an amazing job, and the one in France is a special place for me, as they all are, I'm sure, for all families. But that's my ultimate hope. Who knows? But that's my hope.
You know, one of the interesting things, you know, we're talking a little bit about Epinal, France, you know, our American cemetery there. There's a lot of locals, local French people that actually adopt those graves and take care of them and maintain them. And has anybody kind of taken over your father's grave?
Yes, they do. And every Memorial Day, they come out, they light candles, they put flags up. I'm in the process of trying to find the name of the family that's adopted my father. I know it's happened. I just want to thank them in person, and well, certainly by letter or mail, but hopefully someday in person, be able to do that. And there will be stars aligned correctly. A movie made about 7th Army, which was Patch's Army, that didn't get all the headlines that Patton's Army did.
Yeah.
But the 70th Division that my dad was part of was a part of this. And there's a movie in the works, and it's being generated. And the reason I mention that is this movie's interest in fundraising is being generated by a woman who lives in Epinal and who helps coordinate the adoption program that you just mentioned. I mean, it's amazing the commitment of the French people to these soldiers.
Yeah, 75 years later, and they're still, you know,
so
appreciative of what the American and Canadian and other forces, you know, the Allied forces that came through. And
yeah.
They're so appreciative of what we did for them.
It's so humbling. Well, thanks, John. I've enjoyed visiting with you.
Again, I want to thank you, Cal, for your time and telling us about your father's sacrifice for our country in France and for your uncle's sacrifice in the Philippines during World War II. I also want to thank our listeners for staying with us to the very end of this podcast. The exciting news that we wanted to share has to do with this story and the remains of Lieutenants Calhoun and Graves. The disinterments of these two graves marks the first modern disinterment of men who were killed in action during the fighting on Bataan, but were possibly buried as unknowns at the Manila American Cemetery. It is with great hope for these two families that this research is spot on and these men will be identified. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to Stories of Sacrifice, World War II, American, POW, MIAs in the Philippines. This has been a production of the U.S. POW, MIA Family Locating. You can find us on the web at POW MIA Family Locating.com. Opinions expressed in this podcast are our own and given in the best intention. Overall, the POW MIA accounting community is doing what it can with limited resources.
It is our hope additional federal funding will be provided, along with additional partnerships established to disinter and process the remains of our unknowns located in the national cemeteries. You can help by contacting your congressional representatives and asking that they implement a DNA lead policy for those unknown POW MIAs. Thank you for listening.
How many steps do you take before you have foot pain? Hi, it's Jonathan Cotton with the Good Feet Store, and the truth is, the battle between our feet and the concrete or asphalt usually winds up with our feet losing. Studies show that about 75% of people will experience some kind of foot pain by middle age. I found that out a number of years ago with plantar fasciitis, and I tried to remedy it with shoes and drugstore cushions that didn't work. Finally, I went to the Good Feet Store, was personally fitted for arch supports, and I love them so much, I bought the store. Without a plan to protect and support your feet, it is likely you could one day be one of the millions living with chronic foot pain. Don't wait until pain demands that you visit us. Stop by the Good Feet Store today and let one of our trained arch support specialists fit you with your personal system of arch supports.
The Good Feet Store is located in Fairfax, Leesburg, Rockville, Baltimore and Hunt Valley, and in Annapolis in the Annapolis Harbor Center. For more information, go to goodfeet.com.
You know when you order a new video game, or a golf club, or a blender, and then it arrives at your door, you get a little thrill. Imagine how much more thrilling it is when you order a new car. With Nissan at Home, you can shop for the perfect ride and order it without ever having to go anywhere. Sure beats a golf club or a blender. Buy a new car entirely online with Nissan at Home. Delivered direct from dealer to driveway. Thrill starts here. Services may vary at participating dealers, subject to applicable law. See dealer for details.